Okay, I appreciated so much your having this song just before I speak here because it has long fascinated me. You know, Annie Smith is an interesting individual in early Adventism. In 1844, when our movement really just began, you want to guess how old Annie was? She was 15, turning 16, right along in there, about 16 years of age. Her brother, Uriah, who would later edit the Review and write, among other things, Daniel and Revelation, was 12 years old. J.N. Andrews was 15. James White, the old one of the bunch, was 22. And a number of the other of our pioneers were very, very young. The pioneers of this message, with the exception of Cap'n Bates and a few somewhat older folk like Hiram Edson, were amazingly young people, many of them in their teenage years. When the Lord had a tough job he wanted done, with vigor and with imagination, who'd he go to? The kids. Now tell me something, has anything changed? We need our young people to finish this work. My generation, I'll be perfectly frank to say, has blown it. We've dropped the ball from 50 feet in the air. What we need is the power and vision of young people to pick the work up and carry it forward. And I say that because a lot of times, at least out in California where I come from, I hear people frequently say, you know, our message, our Advent message as we have come to know it, isn't really fit for young people. It's an old person's religion. We have to reinvent Adventism to win our youth. Well, I had news for you, folk. This wasn't dreamed up by old folks. It was dreamed up by teenagers. It was good enough for them then. It's good enough for the young mind now. The Lord chose young people to help get this work started because older folk didn't dare to dream that big. Teenagers could. So thank the Lord for the young mind. And here is Annie Smith, who you notice died at a very, very young age. She only lived to 1852. Now, I agree in part, you know, somebody said that that verse 3 would relate to Elder Andrews, and it very well may have. She may have had him in mind when she wrote this hymn. I should say she died in 1855. She wrote the hymn in 1852. But Andrews didn't go to Europe till 74. And this is a story of somebody doing a missionary venture, leaving behind his cherished friends of early years and trotting a path of difficulty. And I long thought that has to be an account of J.N. Andrews going to the mission field. The problem was, by the time he left, Annie Smith had been dead 19 years. So among those who study Adventist history, there's been a lot of speculation, what's she really talking about here? And if you read the life of Annie Smith, what she's describing here is herself. She was a very, very gifted linguist. She was very, very good at English. Her ambition was to go out and become a professor of English or teach at women's schools and teach English and teach literature. And she was good enough, she could have done it easily. She kind of drifted away from her devout adherence to the faith for a brief time. Then she had a dream. She found herself in a meeting, sitting on the back row, listening to an Adventist preacher up front, and hearing him talk about a specific doctrinal point. Interestingly enough, the preacher, who was, by the way, who? Joseph Bates, had a dream about that same time that he was up speaking in front of a group of Adventist believers, and a young woman came in. There was only one seat left in the back. She sat down, and he felt impressed to change his address and speak about a particular topic. The same one in her dream she had heard the preacher talking about. Not long thereafter, Bates was up in front. He was speaking. A young woman walked in, sat down in the last seat in the back. That was Annie Smith, coming, kind of being drawn back to the Advent message. Bates remembered his dream, changed his topic, preached on a new topic. After the meeting, Annie walked up. She said, "Elder Bates, I had a dream." He said, "So did I." And she came back into the message, and for a few brief, brilliant years, She lent her just awesome talent to the writing of really fine quality hymns. And we still have a number of her hymns in the hymn book, and that's the one you sang a moment ago. But my hunch is verse 3, the one who left behind the cherished friends of early years and resigned wealth and pleasure and honor was Annie. And to hide that, she used the male pronoun in the verse. So make of it what you want to, but there's some fascinating stories in some of the connected with some of the songs that we sing coming out of the Advent movement and the Millerite movement. All right, let's open the Word. And before we do, let's just be in prayer once more, shall we? Dear Lord, we're about to open your Word, and if the Holy Spirit isn't here to give meaning to this, it's just going to be words, Lord. And so we just intensely pray that the Holy Spirit will intervene and give these words meaning for all of us, for Jesus' sake. Amen. All right, let's look at Daniel 12. Daniel 12, verse 1. Daniel's looking way downstream in time, and he sees a future he never lives to actually experience personally. And at that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince which standeth for the children of thy people. And there shall be a time of trouble, such as never was since there was a nation. And from that we can draw a very logical conclusion. If you think that the Bible is an acceptable authority source, and if it isn't, we've got nothing left, then human history obviously does not end quietly. You know, this whole story of human life does not come to a quiet, easy end. There's one last awful spasm of disorder, evidently terrifying disorder, such that without divine intervention, no living thing could survive. Jesus himself, in predicting this era, said if the time was not cut short, no living thing would survive. Now, that, in the time of our pioneers, you had to accept on faith. Today, living with a world of terrorism, where, as I pointed out last night, my reason for last night's talk was to show you how real prophecy is becoming and the world is being handed to us. And the array of weaponry easily and inexpensively available to the terrorist is now so intense that Daniel 12 is beginning to materialize before our eyes like an image coming at us through the fog. We're beginning to see it in real time. Now, Ellen White did an interesting amplification on this, and without embarrassment or apology, I will quote not only from the Scriptures, but from Ellen White while I'm speaking this weekend. Because, folks, I will take help in whatever form it comes, long as it has the inspiration of the Holy Spirit behind it. I know I'm in a combat zone. If I have a chance to read something from the Lord, I'm going to read it because life itself is at stake here. So Ellen White does a very interesting amplification on this, and you can find it. I encourage you to do your own research on this. Go home and read it in Maranatha, page 137, or if you don't have that excellent little book, then you get out volume 8, page 50, and you'll find the same thing. And here is her take on that on the world in which we will probably soon find ourselves. As it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be when the Son of Man shall be revealed. Soon there will be death and destruction, increasing crime, and cruel evil working against the rich who have exalted themselves against the poor. Now let me stop a second. This was written in 1904, right when the Bolshevik Revolution was beginning to try to happen. About 1904, 1905, Lenin went back into Russia, tried to foment revolution, couldn't make it, had to flee back to Western Europe, but revolution is starting to nibble at the fringes of the civilized world back in 1904. So she said there will be cruel evil working against the rich who have exalted themselves against the poor. Those who are without God's protection will find no safety in any place or position. No safety anywhere on earth. Now, she said that when the largest weapon on earth, I've researched it, the largest weapon on planet earth with a 16.5-inch gun, just slightly larger than the guns we later mounted on the battleship Missouri and Wisconsin and some of those big battle wagons. The thing was huge. It could fire a projectile over the horizon, but it's nothing like what Ellen White's describing. What she's describing is no safe place on Earth. 1904 is when she makes this prediction. By the way, you know what else was going on in 1904? Over at the University of Zurich, a brilliant young German Jew, a graduate student in theoretical physics by the name of Albert Einstein, was formulating the special theory of relativity. You know something? I just believe the critics. She was a plagiarist. She plagiarized this. She plagiarized it from Einstein's theory. Now, do you get the point? Nobody but one man on Earth understood the special theory in this time. Not very many people still do today, but when she described it, Einstein was just beginning to formulate the theory that 41 years later would go boom over Hiroshima. So in other words, in this statement in Volume 8, she describes humanity just kind of teetering on the portals of the nuclear age. All right. So what have we said here? Inspiration has penned some pictures. Daniel describes the time worse than anything in human history. I mean, worse than the fall of Rome, when wild barbarians flooded into one of history's most cultured cities and left the Western world in ruins for 1,000 years. Daniel says it's the worst thing that will ever happen in human history. And Ellen White describes class warfare, poor against rich, with cruelty against the rich, and strange new weapons so powerful you don't get away from them anywhere on Earth. All right, now we've gotten it from Daniel. We've gotten an amplification of that from Ellen White. Now, what do you say we go to the words of Jesus? Isn't that a nice place to settle? Let's go to the words of our Lord. And turn, if you will, to Luke 21. Luke 21, 25. And Jesus is describing an end-time world, and he has an interesting sequence of events. And there shall be signs in the sun, moon, and stars, and he gives them in that order, and upon the earth distress of nations with perplexity. Nobody quite knows what to make of the future. Nobody's got a ready answer. People are perplexed. And then Jesus lapses into this beautiful Hebrew symbolism. You know, our Lord was a Jew. And he spoke like a Jew. And there's nobody like the Jewish people in the Hebrew language to put things in just graphic, three-dimensional symbolism. And he goes into that and he says, the sea and the waves roaring. Now, I suppose, you know, if we're going to read the Bible simplistically like some modern apocalyptic writers have done, we would just say there will be tidal waves. It's much deeper than that. In the Bible, what does water represent? People. You ever stop to think how brilliant the biblical symbols are? Isn't water a perfect illustration of people? Think about it. Water will assume the shape of whatever vessel it's in. If the vessel's name is Adolf Hitler, people will assume that shape. If it's Mussolini, they will accept that shape. If it's President Washington, they will accept that shape. People are very fluid. They just accept the shape of whatever vessel they find themselves in. Normally, they're rather placid, but when wind blows on water, what happens? Suddenly, that calm surface of the water becomes a storm. And so you have strife. Water, very, very good illustration of people. And Jesus describes a time which he says, the sea and the waves roaring. What's he saying? The world population will be in ferment and there will be an oncoming storm. Does that make sense to you? All right, a storm such that, in verse 26, he says, men's hearts failing them for fear and for looking after those things which are coming on the earth. Now, just by way of comparison, and I enjoy reading various translations of the Bible in parallel. I do my research from the King James or the New King James, but I enjoy seeing parallel quotations, and interestingly enough, some of our other translations are much clearer on Adventist doctrine than is the King James sometimes. Very clear. Well, the NIV in this particular instance puts it very graphically. In verse 26, it says, men will faint from terror. And it uses the word terror, not insignificant to us living in our era, apprehensive of what is coming on the world. All right, now there's the picture Jesus paints. Luke 21, verses 25 and 26. Notice the sequence, because we're going to encounter this again in just a few moments. Signs where? In the sun, moon, and stars. In other words, a dark day, a bloody moon, and falling stars. All right? And after that, an increasingly frightened world. Now, in our postmodern era, even postmodern Adventism, I hear people say, wait a second, you know, the falling stars, the bloody moon, what does that have to do with now? Well, now should never have happened. The Lord did not intend for us to still be bogged down in this world in the 21st century, as early as 1883 said, Ellen White said the Lord intended to come before now. And in the era in which the Advent message had to get started and people had to be alerted to it, those very, very recent events, a dark day, a bloody moon, falling stars, focused people's mind in the best possible way on the events of the Advent. And they're still relevant today for that reason. That's what got this movement started. So Jesus predicts events in that sequence, and he says it goes on until men will faint with terror. Now, at this point, I guess we could be indulging a real high in doom and gloom. You know, all we've talked about so far is just a whole bunch of bad stuff. You know, think about it. Daniel 12, Luke 21, statements from Ellen White. Very real, very accurate, very recognizable for today's world, and potentially very discouraging, right? You could read this stuff all day and get a real high on fear. Don't do it. Our high in Adventism should not come from fear. That's a selfish motivation. It will never keep you near the Lord. Because when you get over fear, you're going to get over what brought you to the cross, right? Ellen White was on a boat one time. They got in a terrible storm, I think, off of Long Island Sound. And the passengers didn't think they were going to make it. And they began to weep and cry and promise the Lord all kinds of things. She said, as soon as they safely got into port there in down east in New England, one lady who had been just crying and pleading with the Lord got off and almost in a profane way began making fun of what had happened. And you can see that motivation operating. Fear is not a predictable way to come to the Lord. It's not a good reason to come to the Lord. So before we just dwell on nothing but the bad news here, now let's go back to Daniel 12, because we didn't read the whole verse, and some of you probably noticed that we didn't read the whole verse. In Daniel 12, 1, Daniel describes a time in which men will be facing problems like history has never presented them with before. Michael will stand up. There will be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation. And then how does the verse end? And at that time, what happens? Thy people shall be delivered, everyone that is found written in the book. See, the end message of Daniel 12:1 is not focusing on the crisis, it's focusing on the delivery. In spite of the problem, God's people get delivered. Daniel 12:1 is not a book of or a verse of doom and gloom, it's a verse of delivery for those whose names are found written in the book. My friends, today we need to be written in that book. And that's why we're here. That's our hope and that's our safety and that's why we're here today. So our message, the Advent message, is one of hope, not one of despair. When these things begin to happen, what Jesus say his believers should do? Look up and recognize your redemption draweth nigh. But meanwhile, even though our focus is on the hope of the second coming, shouldn't we be intelligent about what's happening in our world? And if it's not important to think about these things, even the problems, and to learn to recognize them, then why did Daniel and Jesus bother to describe them? See? So we have to intelligently study this material, but we want to do so not from an era of doom and gloom. And so our topic this afternoon is Anarchy and the End Times, a Biblical View of Terrorism. That's what we're going to be talking about. Now, let me get my marking pen here. And just say, as I did last night, that as one studies the history of the Advent movement, with its ups and downs, its good times and its bad, you will notice that following close beside it and never very far away is a companion track. It's almost like a railroad train where something follows and parallels Adventism and dogs its heels, so to speak. So two things seem to move together. They're never very far apart from each other. One of them is the Advent message. It's filled with hope. It's filled with the love of the Lord. It's filled with the promise of life and the coming of Jesus. The other line paralleling it very, very closely is one of strife. It's one happening out in the secular world. A time of strife. And there seems to be a strange associational relationship between the two. In other words, it seems to me, as you go back and look at the history of God's people, that every time God's people are about to do something special, somewhere along this timeline, the Lord creates an opportunity. There is a prophetic event that needs to be fulfilled. Every time the Lord creates an opportunity, the devil comes along and parallels it out in the secular world by brewing up frightening levels of world disorder, many times approaching anarchy. Now, let me give you an example. Let me mention the year 1798. Does that mean anything to anybody here? What does it suggest to you? French Revolution. What else? Yeah, the time of the end. Now, let's go over here to 1798. And let's draw our timeline, and we're going to see some interesting things happening here. 1798 is a date that is not insignificant to students of Bible prophecy. It is the end of the great 1260-year prophecy, is it not? Okay? You're aware, you know, that back in 538, AD 538, the last of those three rebellious pagan tribes was subdued by the Roman Church. I think it was the Ostrogoths, was it not? I think they were the last ones to be subdued. So at this point, Rome becomes supreme. And the power of the Roman Church then gets welded into and fused with the power of the Roman state and the states that then exist across fragmented Europe. And you have a union of church and state so that pretty soon the state is enforcing what the church defines to be right doing. Okay? By the way, the Inquisition was not dreamed up by bad people necessarily just wanting to do bad things. The Inquisition was dreamed up by people who wanted a moral community, religious continuity between believers, and peace and safety. They wanted everyone thinking alike, and they wanted a stable environment. When that was threatened, for example, by Sabbatarians up in the Waldensian Mountains, those good people rapidly resorted to physical force. That's why our Constitution is so precious. The Constitution protects the minority from the majority. Well, in any event, Rome becomes supreme, but the Bible predicts what? How many years are going to take place between the fall of that last pagan tribe and the end of religious persecution? 1260 years. So the date 1798 should be very, very clear to us as an ending point for a major Bible prophecy. All right, on that date, what happens? There's this curly-headed French general by the name of Louis Berthier. And he's a very, very skilled tactician, one of Napoleon's major mainstays in his military forces. Napoleon's mother was a faithful Catholic, and she told him, "Bonaparte, don't you ever touch the Holy Father. Leave him be. Don't touch him." Napoleon didn't. He just turned Louis Berthier loose. Berthier went into Rome, captured Pius VI, who, as popes went, was not a bad old fellow. He was infirm. He was ill. You know, in many ways, he was one of the more pious of the popes, and there had been some who were anything but pious. Not a bad gentleman, but he's captured here, and so persecution comes to an end, and the time of the end begins, okay? So we have 1798 as a very significant time in terms of our Adventist message and what's going to be happening here. By the way, before I go on, thank you, ladies, for a wonderful lunch. Now, Elle told me that I would be well fed here, and believe me, it is worth a drive across the country to have lunch at Walnutport. Your reputation has preceded you, and you've lived up to it famously. My only problem was I didn't have nearly as big enough plate as I needed, you know, to try everything, but I sure tried. And we had the privilege of dining with a young gentleman by the name of Levi. And after I was done with my dinner, Levi came to me and said, "If you're going to eat dessert, you might want to try my mom's." And I did, and it was everything Levi had said it would be. It was delicious, okay? So thank you for that good tip. I appreciate it. And I see Levi's face briefly there at the door. Anyway, thank you very much, ladies. You have done, I've eaten potlucks all over the world, including feasts in the South Pacific, and I've never eaten anything better than what we had here. Now, we've all had the same experience, haven't we? Hey, y'all aren't going to go to sleep on me, are you? Because it was a wonderful lunch, and I know what those things do. Anyway, here is 1798. Religious liberty reemerges, and simultaneously, just in this very period of time, right along in here, what appears on the political scene? Just as predicted in Revelation 13. 1787, what happens? Well, in France, but in America, what happens here? Spring of 87, travelers from all over the United States, all of the states, come toward a common center focused on Philadelphia. They go into Constitution Hall, they write the Constitution, and it is adopted in September of 87. So right in here, appearing just as Bible prophecy has predicted, the United States begins to be a independent power on the world scene. All right. Now soon, very, very soon after this, just along here in the new century, just a few decades or a few years into it, itinerant preachers are going to begin traveling around first the eastern seaboard of the United States, then over in England and mainland Europe, and they will be preaching something about the Advent message. Now think about it. At this point here, in 1798, there have already been powerful signs that heaven is gearing up to do something. What was it, 1755 in the Lisbon earthquake? Have I got my date right for that? 1755, Lisbon collapses in an earthquake that is felt as far as Scandinavia and as far south as northern Africa. Huge earthquake. Now, it's easy, you know, from this vantage point to say, you know, kind of yawn and say, so Lisbon got sacked, so what? Well, back in that era, right in the era when the Advent was going to begin, heaven sends these signals. There is no internet. There's no CNN. Heaven uses physical phenomenon to get the attention of the world, and they get it in the big time. Well, just a few years later, May 19, 1780, the sun suddenly just seems to go out over northern New England. And that night, the moon rises like a bloody moon, and now people begin to put this together, and non-believers are beginning to wonder if the Day of Judgment is coming. And in 1798, as you pose yourself right on that in that era, just 35 years later, the stars are going to fall. Down here in 1833, and Joellen's great-granddad, great-grandmother saw them fall and described it to your, wasn't it to your dad? Was he still living? So Joellen is one generation removed from somebody who had seen that happen and transmitted to her dad. And she said she went out to the well, you know, with a bucket, going to get some water, and it seemed like all the stars in the sky were going to fall right in her bucket. Just a colossal meteorite shower. And almost immediately thereafter, this farmer by the name of William Miller begins to preach. So William Miller, in the 1830s and the late 1830s, begins to preach. And it's obvious what's happening here. Heaven is gearing up for the Advent, impressing various people to play their part in the message that has to get set out. And Miller preaches a message you can't ignore. He says there's a real possibility this generation is going to see Jesus come. You're going to see the face of God. And he seemed to have the facts and figures to back him up. Even non-believers would go into a Millerite meeting and they would come out converted. And one of the reasons why was because a 2300-day prophecy, another Bible prophecy, seemed to be working. 2300-year prophecy accurately foretold the very year of Jesus' baptism, the very year of his crucifixion, the year of the stoning of Stephen. So three times before, this prophecy has worked. Now the end of it buries its nose now out in 1844. It's a little hard to ignore. And if you were trying to ignore it, along came this Adventist preacher by the name of Josiah Litch. And he'd been studying prophecy. He says, you know, the way I take it, the way I take prophecy, on an August day in 1840, Turkey's going to collapse as a world power. Well, now that kind of stuff is a little hard to ignore. People are all watching the newspapers to see if this prediction comes through, and it does. Turkey sues for protection from major British powers on the very August day in 1840 that Josiah Litch had said prophecy foretold. And the result was that literally thousands of people, as we're getting down here in 1840, thousands of people begin to join the Millerite movement, so that at the time of the disappointment, something like 100,000 people were active members of the Millerite movement. All right. Well, the day came and went. There was a great disappointment. And after Miller, just 46 years after 1798, there would be a little remnant of believers who would start to challenge the world with a message that had never been given before. Fear God and give glory to Him, for the hour of His judgment is come. So what we're saying here is that from 1798, from right in here, just 46 years downstream in time, the judgment hour message begins to be given. Now, if you are Lucifer and you know the Bible from memory, you've got it clear in your mind what the Bible says, and you understand Bible prophecy, in 1798 or 97, along in there, would you be able to see this coming? Huh? I mean, I know the lunch was good, but wake up, folks. If you were Lucifer and you understood Bible prophecy, couldn't you figure out in the year 1798 that something big is on the scene, is coming down the scene here towards you, and by 1844 you're going to be facing God's last final offensive in the war? If you were Lucifer, what would you do? You'd cause trouble. Exactly right. Now let's guess just a little further as to what the trouble looked like. 1797-98, right along in there, we had, as you correctly said, the French Revolution. Let me read you a description of it from just a brief encyclopedic description. The revolutionary movement shook France between 1787 and 1799. The great fear of July led the peasants to rise against their lords. The nobles and the bourgeois now took flight. War broke out. France suffered defeats. Prussia joined the war in July. Now notice how quickly this thing moves. Ellen White one time said, great changes are soon to take place in our world and the final movements will be rapid ones. Lucifer is responding to the incipient Advent message with a counterattack in the civil world, in the world of warfare. In July, Prussia joins the war. Austro-Prussian army crosses the frontier, rapidly advances toward Paris. The bourgeois, the working class, thought they'd been betrayed by the king and the aristocrats. So by August 10, just the next month, revolutionaries rose, occupied the Tuileries Palace. Now Louis XIV, who had lived in absolute splendor, along with Marie Antoinette, was suddenly besieged by angry masses he couldn't defend against. You know what happened to him finally, right? He went to the guillotine. August 10, they occupy the Tuileries Palace. By September, just another month later, the Parisian crowd breaks into the prisons, massacres the noble and the clergy, and anarchy reigns in France. Anarchy. All right. Just as heaven is setting up world events for a speedy proclamation of the Advent movement, Lucifer counterattacks with wild disorder that draws in much of Europe and makes it impossible to do the work in the easy way the Lord intended it to be done. All right. Now, with that in mind, it's kind of interesting to read a word picture by Ellen White. And you can find this in Education, page 228. Education 228. Anarchy. She uses that word. Anarchy is seeking to sweep away all law. not only divine but human. Now bear in mind, when we get rid of the Ten Commandments, we've lost the basis for law and order, and human law goes with it. The centralizing of wealth and power, the vast combinations for the enriching of the few at the expense of the many, the combinations of the poorer classes for the defense of their interests and claims, the spirit of riot and bloodshed, the same teachings that led to the French Revolution, all are tending to involve the whole world in a struggle similar to that which convulsed France. Education 228. What I've been talking about here and belaboring for just a few minutes, if we recount some Adventist history and fulfilled prophecy, is not irrelevant to us. What happened in the French Revolution will, Ellen White says, be repeated on a global scale. What we saw in the French Revolution, I remember from my history major in college studying, it was a depressing subject to study, was just nationwide anarchy. Nobody was in charge of anything. Nobody was safe. So, in 1798, as heaven was preparing to give the world the Advent message, Lucifer counterattacks. But you know, the good news is, for whatever Lucifer does, there's always still a king on the throne. And the Lord's still in charge, and he still is in charge of human history. And what happens? The French Revolution runs through kind of a sinusoidal hump of real disorder, and then comes along this Corsican military genius by the name of Napoleon Bonaparte. He begins to impose order on France. By 1798, Pius VI is in captivity. The reign of persecution is over. And Napoleon formulates something called the Napoleonic Code. And France returns to law and order. And then under Napoleon's brilliant leadership, for a time, goes right to the pinnacle of world power. Okay? So the devil's trying to stir up disorder and anarchy. The Lord intervenes. Stability is brought back to France, and France goes right to the zenith of world power. All right, that's view number one, but it's not the only one. This down here is about 1798 and what the devil tried to do to form a parallel rail along the track that the Lord was trying to follow to lead God's people speedy proclamation of the Advent. Soon, however, we get another glimpse of the same thing. Now let's go down to 1844. Okay? And since we've made this railroad track, let me make it look a little more real for you. Okay? There's the railway to heaven. Now, 1844. What happens in 1844? A lot of people who want to see Jesus come and are well-intended misinterpret a prophecy because they buy into Protestantism's then generally accepted notion that the sanctuary is the earth. That's what went wrong with William Miller. Everything else he had was right. But he buys into this thing popularly preached in Sunday sermons all over the country that the sanctuary described in the book of Daniel is this earth. So when the Lord comes to cleanse the sanctuary, he's coming to cleanse the earth. That was the misapplication. Out of this misapplication comes a shaking. And on the morning of October 22, 1844, there are 100,000 Millerites. By the evening of that day, certainly after midnight, by the morning of October 23, there are a few dozen left. That is Gideon's army. Now, we talk about the shaking of Adventism, you know, the shaking that will occur in our church. We say, can we survive it? Of course we can survive it. That's how we began. The Lord began this message with a sifting process to find those who would really go back into the Word of God and rest their hope on this, not on their personal presuppositions. They went back into the Word. They began to rediscover truth. And out of that, they began to find an old truth, suddenly a new truth about the end time judgment. And they begin to proclaim this message never before heard in the history of the world. Fear God and give glory to Him, for the hour of His judgment is come. So the judgment hour message begins to get proclaimed. Now watch Lucifer respond. Lucifer responded big time over here with the French Revolution. You think he's going to do anything in 1844? Now, what is it God's people have to remind the world of? They have to remind the world of the Sabbath truth, right? They have to tell the world about judgment. They have to tell the world about the fall of Babylon. There are unique things they have to say. One of the major things they will talk about will be the seventh day Sabbath, which is a memorial of what? Creation. Guess what Lucifer counterattacks with here? In 1844, count them up, 1844, Charles Darwin does his draft of what will become Origin of the Species. The title of it, if you want to look it up, in a good library. You're going to have to go to a good research library to find it. But the title of the document is Geological Observations on the Volcanic Islands Visited During the Voyage of HMS Beagle, 1844. Darwin's first publication is in that very year. But he's not the only one. It's one thing to impose the concept of evolution on the world, but everybody might not buy it. What Satan is trying to do here is to wipe God out of the human equation. And in addition to this, he brings in another helper by the name of Karl Marx. In 1844, Karl Marx writes his first draft called Economic and Philosophic Manuscripts of 1844. That will mature by 1848 to become a document that our Russian friends used to call Manifest Komunistической Partii, Manifesto of the Communist Party. Okay? So we have Marx here with dialectic materialism and atheism as a fine complement to Darwin's suggestion that there is no God and the world just occurred by reason of accident. Now, within 4 years, guess what happens in the world? Now we're going down here to 1848. The philosophic opposition to the Advent message gets presented here, but in 1848, guess what happens in Europe? Marx's ideas and those of other anarchists begin to take over, and historians now look back on something called the revolutions of 1848. Let me describe them for you. They began in Italy. Began in Italy, January of 1848. By February, they spread to France. Now, earlier, I pointed out to you how this stuff happened rapidly, month by month. You can see the rapid advance of anarchy. Same thing in 1848. January, Italy explodes in revolution. In February, France does. Soon, it engulfs most of mainland Europe. Insurrections, that's just mobs, armed mobs in the streets, break out in the capitals of the three great monarchies, Paris, Vienna, and Berlin. And the governments are virtually powerless because they're afraid of the revolution. They do little to defend themselves. Anarchy breaks out in the revolutions of 1848. And across Europe, you see anarchy. You saw it in the French Revolution. You saw anarchy there. Now it expands to include not just France, but most of mainland Europe. And in the year 1842, it's kind of interesting. Any of you here who, you know, managed to stay awake during, you know, sophomore or junior English literature, anybody here remember a guy by the name of Alfred Lord Tennyson? That name ring a bell? Well, in 1842, Tennyson wrote a poem, and it just fascinates me because it's just almost like a prophecy. He called it Locksley Hall, and here's what he said in 1842. For I dipped into the future, far as human eye could see, and saw a vision of the world and all the wonder there would be. Saw the heavens fill with commerce, argosies of magic sails, pilots of the purple twilight dropping down with costly bales. He's seeing people in the air. Heard the heavens fill with shouting, and there rained a ghastly dew from the nation's airy navies grappling in the central blue. Far along the worldwide whisper of the south wind rushing warm with the standards of the peoples plunging through the thunderstorm. Alfred Lord Tennyson, 1842, he foresees flight, and he foresees fights in the air. And it sure did happen. Well, that takes us down as far as 1844 and 1848, but we ain't done yet. Every time God's people are poised for something major, the devil responds with anarchy. Now let's go down to 1856. 1856 is interesting because it kind of comes out of something that happens inside Adventism. In that era, most Sabbath-keeping Adventists had this rather self-righteous view that the Laodicean message was not intended for them. They were Philadelphia because they had accepted the Sabbath. Laodicea was a rebuke, they reasoned, to the Sunday-keeping Adventists who hadn't seen the fourth commandment. Until one day in 1856, James White published an editorial in the Review. And he said, wait a second, folks, read it again. The Laodicean message applies to us. And the people in the church, there were about 2,000 Adventists by that time, and of the 2,000 Adventists, a huge proportion, several hundred letters, came in to the editorial offices of James White at the Review there in Battle Creek, and they said, Elder White, you're right. It does apply to us, and I see myself as I've never seen it before. My friends, we need to have personal encounters with the Laodicean message. Anytime we decide, you know, that we're pretty good, we're kind of getting a little proud of ourselves and feeling that we have a lot of wealth of knowledge and success in our personal lives, read the Laodicean message, it kind of sobers you up. Anyway, across the church, people responded by the hundreds, and they said, Elder White, I recognize that this thing applies to me. Now, as a result of that, something happened in Adventism. As the Laodicean message began to promulgate itself across the church, and people really began to get revival and reformation from it, there was this huge upsurge of spirituality. 1856, the publication is put in the Review. And there is this huge upward surge of revival and reformation within Adventism. And there are accounts from that era of even ordained ministers standing in the pulpit and basically just making open confession to their congregations. I remember reading one where the pastor said, I've been wrong-headed in word and action. I have not treated my congregation right. He makes confession of that, and then he says, I mean to make straight work and arise with the remnant. I mean, when pastors confess to their congregations from the sacred desk, that's called revival. And as a result, God's people began to have enormous revival within the church. Now, something interesting happened. Just a few months later, there began to be, out in the non-Adventist Christian world, a similar revival and reformation. And religious historians to this day can't tell you why it happened. It just did. And in the business offices in places like Philly and Baltimore and Washington and New York, businessmen at noon would not take lunch. They would have prayer meetings in their offices. And today, the historian looking at this has given it a name. We call it a revival with a million converts. And no church started this thing. Nobody to this day can figure out why that revival and reformation occurred in the non-Adventist Protestant world. Interestingly enough, right before it happened, right about in here, Ellen White wrote a testimony, I think it was in Volume 1, in which she said, in response to this revival among God's people, I saw angels being sent everywhere to prepare unbelieving hearts for truth. So what happens here is heaven sends the angels out, and quickly their effect is felt, and across the church there is a conviction among most Adventists that this thing is going to lead direct to the second coming. They're not coming back down again. They plan to go on into infinity. Only problem was God's people didn't hang on to it. And a few months later, this revival began to come back down because the economy began to heat up. There was money to be made in speculating in mining stock and other business activities. And God's people fell back in love with the world and the revival collapsed. Guess what happened to the revival with a million converts? It came back down too, and when it's buried its nose back in planet Earth, a group of angry Southerners primed their guns around Fort Sumter, and the Civil War began. Once again, we have something I won't say approaching anarchy, but certainly approaching a level of disturbance that markedly hindered the advance of the work of God. Now, let me read you something from Ellen White here. It's kind of fascinating. Just before the war broke out, she was up in Parkfield, Michigan, in January of 1861. This is 3 months to the day before Fort Sumter is fired on. By this time, the revival has collapsed in Adventism. It's collapsed out in the non-Adventist world. Civil war is coming. You can almost sense it coming. And over at Parkville, Michigan, they were just dedicating their church, and James White was there, and Ellen White was there, and Elder White stood up and gave what was called a stirring exhortation, and then Ellen White stood up. She gave a little address to the Parkville church. Then she was taken off in vision. Of course, the people in the room were just awestruck. Here they're sitting there, and there's this person in vision, you know, in communion with heaven. After coming out of vision, she arose, and she stood, and she looked around the room. She looked at the various faces there, and she said, I'm quoting now, "There is not a person in this house who has even dreamed of the trouble that is coming upon this land. People are making sport of the secession ordinance of South Carolina, but I've just been shown that a large number of states are going to join that state. There will be a most terrible war." She says this when everybody on both the north and southern sides is saying, we'll lick them in 6 months. This won't last long. It won't take long, folks. Just enlist for 6 months, because by that time the war will be over. Both sides expected to win. Going back to her words, she said, "In this vision, I've seen large armies of both sides gathered on the field of battle. I heard the booming of the cannon, saw the dead and dying on every hand. I saw them rushed up, engaged in hand-to-hand fighting." It is a graphic description of what later happened, 6 months later. Perfect description of the Civil War. Then she said, "I saw the field after the battle all covered with the dead and dying. I was taken to the homes of those who had lost husbands, sons, or brothers in the war. I saw distress and anguish." Then she stopped for a moment, looked around the house again, and she said, "There are those in this room who will lose sons in that war." And they did. Where'd she plagiarize that from? Or where did she plagiarize in volume 9, page 11 and following, descriptions of tall buildings in New York City disappearing in fires the firemen were unable to stop because they couldn't operate their engines? Well, anyway, once again, 1856 down through about 1860, you see, once again, if it is not anarchy, it certainly is the disturbance of a major conflict, a major war, and General Lucifer, once again, gets in the way of God's people, and it's a real problem for them. All right, that isn't the only time. Let's go down to the year 1900. In the year 1900, we had a chance to finish the work. I say we institutionally, you know, our forebears, our Adventist believers. Everywhere you look, there was prosperity. Everywhere you look, there was peace. We had just fought a, dare I use the term, preemptive war against Spain and gained the Philippines and Cuba and other territory. We had fought a preemptive war. We had just come out of a recession, the recession of 1897. Suddenly, unless you were an idiot, you couldn't fail to make money. I mean, by 1900, people were saying, if you couldn't have made money last year, you're an idiot. Huge upsurge of wealth. Everywhere you look, there was peace, there was wealth, there was prosperity, and with an American or British passport, you'd go anywhere in the world. It was a short time of peace. We could have finished the work at the turn of the last century. That's what caused me to write the book Omega. And I had, for years, as a student of history, been looking at that window of peace and saying, why didn't God's people finish the work then? They had an open world. They had all the money they needed. Nothing stood in their way. Well, of course, what stood in the way was an apostasy within God's church. Ellen White called it the Alpha. Within 2 years, it would stop this church just like a ship hitting an iceberg. Then she would warn, this is the Alpha of major heresies. The Omega will follow. And when it happens, I tremble for God's people. 1900, everything is poised for the quick finishing of the work of God. The devil counterattacks this time on two fronts. One of them inside the church where he incites apostasy, but the outside conjoint force of this pincher movement is another resort to anarchy. Now let me tell you what was happening in 1901. In 1900 and 1901, there was a real problem in the world from anarchists. They were sort of communist type of thinkers out in Europe. They came to the United States. One of them was a silk weaver, an anarchist who came and lived briefly in New Jersey, in a cell. Lived among a group of anarchists in a cell in New Jersey, went back to Europe, and in the summer of 1900, he assassinated the Italian king. And the news just swept across the Western world like a thunderclap. Rumors had it that there were other cells of similar anarchists in Paterson, New Jersey. That is not very far from here. Isn't it interesting it was happening in New Jersey? That's where the first attack on the World Trade Center came from, wasn't it? And the rumor was that these anarchists in Paterson, New Jersey, and other places in the country were planning to assassinate the President of the United States, whose name was William McKinley. That ring a bell? Because he got assassinated. Now, just a month before the Italian king got assassinated, the Prince of Wales had an attempt on his life. There was an attempt on the Shah of Iran. And as immigrants began coming into this country, our customs and immigration people got a little worried about this. They began detaining them. 14 suspicious immigrants were detained entering the United States. The next day, 12 more were detained. And newspapers were openly talking about these anarchist cells in America and the danger that they posed to civilization. Just a year later, September 6, 1901, President McKinley shaking hands with a crowd of well-wishers, and one of these anarchists comes up, sticks out his hand, and then pulls a pistol out of his coat and fires two shots into the president's chest and abdomen, and Teddy Roosevelt inherits the White House. Anarchy. At this moment of opportunity, the devil tries to respond with the old familiar tactic of making world events go bad. All right, now, let's kind of come to the conclusion here and decide where we're going with this. Every time God's people have a chance to go forward, Lucifer intrudes with anarchy. Let me give you one more example, and I think it will suffice. The year is 2001. The Advent is long overdue. As early as 1883, Ellen White was saying Jesus could have come ere this. And once again, in 2001, heaven had obviously moved into human life with powerful forces designed to make the Advent possible. 1991, the Soviet Union collapses, doesn't fire a shot. All of its 40,000 nukes go down with it. I mean, in the whole history of the world, I see nothing to compare with an empire of that power going down to defeat without using a weapon. Meanwhile, there's the Persian Gulf War. The Persian Gulf I demonstrates America's military preeminence. America's left as the world's sole superpower. And right on the heels of that thing, what happens? Shades of 1900 with its prosperity, we get in this country 10 years of the most incredible uptake of wealth our history has ever seen. I mean, the Dow goes past 11,000. There is wealth. There are jobs. There is a Pax Americana where you can take the gospel virtually anywhere in the world if you want to. Heaven is trying to hand us the Advent. If only God's people will recognize what's going on. Problem was, what did we do? We sat back, we enjoyed the wealth, and we didn't seize the moment. Now, during that 10-year period, when we had this moment of opportunity out in the shadows, Lucifer is regrouping in an old familiar pattern. In the heart of Africa, angry zealots, claiming to act in the name of God, attacked two embassies with tragic loss of life, most of it African life. In Saudi Arabia, there's this huge high-rise building called the Khobar Towers where a lot of Americans are barracked. That's destroyed with loss of American life. In Yemen, the USS Cole pulls in for a refueling stop has a hole blown in its side. And Americans are killed by fanatics, perfectly willing to kill themselves just to kill somebody they hate. And meanwhile, in New York City, the World Trade Center is unsuccessfully attacked by bombers who get up early one morning with a rented truck, drive over from Jersey, park in the World Trade Center basement, and cause damage, but don't get what they want. Now it's September 11, 2001. My son is just getting up. He's a law student still. He's a senior law student at Georgetown. Or a junior law student, I should say. He's getting up. Looks out his window at the Capitol, and it's an absolutely gorgeous day. It had been a kind of a stormy night the night before, but the morning sky is cloudless. He can see from the distant Capitol dome up to the Jefferson Memorial, past the Pentagon, and all the way up to the Washington Monument, which is visible through his window on the left. And he's standing there thinking, what a lovely day this is. And the phone rings. It's a telemarketer trying to sell him something. In the midst of that conversation, he suddenly drops the phone, and that telemarketer probably becomes one of the first people outside of Washington to hear what is about to happen. Because at that moment, the sky just fills with a shriek of jet engines. His apartment begins to shake like some monster has it in its teeth. I mean, seven stories of a brick building are shaking like mad, and he looks out the window, and his whole window fills with jetliner. It's American Airlines Flight 77. On which, interestingly enough, he has a ticket just 3 days later. I still got that ticket. American Airlines Flight 77 doesn't exist anymore. They renumbered it. But I got a ticket on that plane with seat 26C assigned. And for a moment, the whole window is filled with airplane. It just misses his roof, misses it by inches, goes through a tree, turns a little bit to avoid the Sheraton Tower just down the street, and then disappears below the low hill that leads to the Pentagon, just out of sight, about a mile away. And the world changes dramatically. 2001. And in the aftermath of that, what do we see? Forces of anarchy nibbling at the fringes of civilization, to the point where now we take our shoes off going through an airport check-in counter, live in fear, and sometimes wonder if we dare open the mail. Do you see, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, a familiar pattern here? Every time it's happened before, God's people have been poised to do something. Are we poised now? Does heaven have something in mind for us to be doing now? And if it does, is there a chance we better do it quickly while we still have time? Anarchy. I'll say it again. At the end of time, we will see anarchy in our world. How do I know that? Well, I'm not smart enough to figure that out myself, but I will trust an inspired source. Great Controversy, page 591. I'm just reading from the 88 edition. You may find it renumbered in a more recent edition. Ellen White put it this way: those who honor the Bible Sabbath will be denounced as enemies of law and order, as breaking down the moral restraints of society and causing anarchy. There will be anarchy out here in our future, because if there weren't, how could we be blamed for it? That's the sad part. It's out there, it will happen, and we'll be blamed for it. Our conscientious scruples will be pronounced obstinacy, stubbornness, and contempt of authority. We will be accused of disaffection toward the government. Which means, brothers and sisters, it means to me it's very, very important to avoid every way we can, avoid every hint of unreasonable antagonism to our government. I mean, the time will come soon enough when we will have to take a conscientious stand on an issue of principle. Before that time comes, we ought to be the best citizens in town. I mean, this country makes mistakes. It's not perfect, but you don't like it here. Go someplace else for a while. Then come back and see how good the stars and stripes look to you. And if in the future we will be wrongly accused of disaffection toward government, isn't it important that we avoid in every possible way we can giving that impression now? It seems to me that just logically it would be important to do that. Don't bring it on. I feel personally very terrible, very, very sad when Adventists are associated with things that are just wildly anti-government. I think of Waco. It just made me sick as I saw on some of the grocery market tabloid covers pictures of Waco and people holding a sign with the word Seventh-day Adventist written on it. Now, why should we be associated with that? Brothers and sisters, with all the truth we have in the Word of God, why should we be suckers for fanaticism? The last thing we should fall for is fanaticism, but so often it seems to come looking for us. So my plea to you is, let's be good citizens, let's be balanced citizens. Let's be, you know, uplifting to our community rather than necessarily antagonistic to it. The time will come soon enough we'll be accused of disaffection toward the government. In legislative halls and courts of justice, commandment keepers will be misrepresented and condemned. That's why it's important to avoid unnecessarily giving that impression. All right, let's close. In Christian Service, page 54, Ellen White said, "The spirit of anarchy is permeating all nations. This is but an indication of the pent-up fires of passion and lawlessness that, having once escaped control, will fill the world with woe and desolation. Before the flood, God sent Noah to warn the world. As the time of Christ's second appearing draws near, the Lord sends His servants." And in November 22 of 1906, she wrote a wonderful little piece. It was designed to be the Sabbath reading for December 22, just a month later. And it was just filled with encouraging advice, even though she frankly dealt with some of the problems we'll face. And it went like this: "Jesus is coming again. The exact day and hour of Christ's coming have not been revealed, but He mentioned certain events by which they might know when His coming was near. Signs in the sun, moon, and stars. The sun shall be dark, and the moon shall not give her light. The stars shall fall. The signs in sun, moon, and stars have been fulfilled. Since that time, earthquakes, tempests, tidal waves have multiplied, declaring that the end is near, that something great and decisive will of necessity soon take place." Now she poses the question, here's our mission to our neighbors. Shall we allow the signs of the end to be fulfilled without telling people of what's coming on the earth? Confusion fills the world. A great terror is soon to come upon human beings. Isn't that interesting? She uses the word terror. Great terror is soon to come upon human beings. The end is very near. We, who know the truth, should be preparing for what is soon to break upon the world as an overwhelming surprise. Now that's our mission. Your neighbor will look at this and not know what to make of it. We do. Isn't it time to share the good news that at the end of the storm there's a rainbow and the King comes home and God's people go with Him? All right, I've talked a little longer than I intended to on this. I have not given this presentation anywhere before because it's brand new, and I'm kind of feeling my way along as to how much time to spend on each point of it. But let's take a little bit of a break here, and then what are we scheduled for? 3:30? What I want to talk about next hour is the Fourth Amendment. And somebody asked me, what is the Fourth Amendment? Well, we're going to learn. And the Fourth Amendment, I think, is the area in which the enemy is attacking our Constitution, preparatory to attacking things like religious liberty. So there's a lot of stuff we have to talk about, a lot of things we have to have clear in our minds. We'll go back to that in about 10 minutes. Thank you.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International copyright, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministry.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He is coming soon.